P-22. RMXT Studio Number 1, Manhattan, New York. Welcome, everyone, to a very special edition of Focus 2020. The show's long-running host, Marion DeClercq, stated into the hard camera directly in front of her central desk position. Our panelists today truly need no introduction, and I don't want to waste any of the time we have, so we'll get right. Time isn't really a factor tonight, the ever-polite Jan Geller interrupted. We're being simulcast to Blitz News, and I know the schedule has been cleared for the rest of the night. Speaking for myself, I know I'm in no rush to sneak back into the shadows like our esteemed ICA chairman tends to do so often. These four individuals on the other side of the desk have spent the past few years telling a lot more than an hour's worth of lies. Now that they've shown up, I don't think we should let them be saved by the bell. Remind me, which one are you again? William Godfrey retorted in Jan's general direction, making a point of not yet gracing her with any eye contact. Marion DeClercq, having expected little else, rolled her eyes and moved on. For Dan McCarthy, even amid this familiarly childish opening salvo, the present moment he was experiencing didn't feel anything like his past appearances on Focus 2020. He thought this went far beyond the total absence of a studio audience, although that clearly played a part, and he certainly wasn't paying any heed to the bizarre legal and contractual situations around this particular episode, which was airing on Blitz News, as Geller had highly predictably wasted no time in pointing out, as well as its usual home. In the hours immediately leading up to the panel, Emma had briefed Dan on the kinds of things he could expect to have to deal with. And in many respects, this briefing did feel like others before it. One key difference in preparation came from the fact that this time, Dan had three reliable allies at his side and three reliable enemies across from him, rather than assorted panelists of varying degrees of friendliness. This was why the show had been billed as a showdown even before the identities of Emma's precise teammates had been known, which, as it went, was only a matter of minutes before the live show began when they were finally spotted by some of the building's staff members walking through the hallway en route to the studio, having been safely and discreetly teleported directly into an empty dressing room. Dan knew that Emma and Godfrey were going to go hard and deep in calling out the trio of snakes for their roles in the Dordaloo Tepe leak, and that they were going to plant some seeds about their potential involvement in other recent events without quite calling them out right away. The strategy was to say just enough to bring relevant thoughts of denial or admission to their minds, at which point Leisha would be able to effortlessly sense those clear thoughts and just as effortlessly pass them on to his human friends. By the end of the hour-long show, or at least by the end of the show's first hour if it did run longer than normal like Jan Geller suggested it could, Dan knew that his enemies would be ruined. Emma and Godfrey would see to that, possessing as they did enough evidence of enough wrongdoing to take them down once and for all, even if Leisha hadn't been there to provide his unique assistance and thus enable them to optimize in real time their lines of both attack and defense. As the show began, Dan found it hard to focus through a general cloud of brain fog. He heard the name Billy Kendrick, but highly indicatively of his lack of mental clarity, wasn't even sure whether it had left the mouth of Slater or Geller. Despite more sleep than he could ever have reasonably budgeted for, Dan felt less able to focus on the show's proceedings than he had been to focus on anything at any point he could remember. Time travel was real. His brain screamed, and his recently mentioned friend Billy Kendrick was on the wrong side of the gate that proved it. The thought of one friend and ally inevitably led to thoughts of two more, however, in the form of Phil Norris and Masoud Demir. Both were dead, and Dan had more than a strong suspicion that he was staring at three people who were implicated in those murders, perhaps to varying degrees, but implicated nonetheless. That was what this was all about, and the reminder focused Dan's mind. He was here not only to calm the situation of dangerous global unease caused by Geller and her new political allies, but to hold them to account for something even worse. In the absence of any aliens, John Cole began, who I must say I did expect to see tonight, allow me to begin with an important point about New Kerguelen. Their easily accessible planet, to my mind and to those of many experts in our free Western nations, offers a veritable bounty of mineral resources that can improve life on Earth without necessarily causing any disagreements between ourselves and the so-called messengers. Right now, we're more or less looking at a tragedy of the commons scenario, and I'd like to hear Chairman Godfrey's view on why we haven't looked into this more thoroughly than we have. This seemed like an oddly tame avenue for Cole to be taking, at least to Dan and Clark, but Emma and Godfrey himself knew there was bound to be a sting in the tail. Still, without knowing what that sting might be, all he could do was give a non-committal stock answer. Well, as a man who has once again reverted to type and become as obstructive as you have should know, John, it has been difficult to cooperate with the messengers while for so long we've been unable to cooperate amongst ourselves. Emma nodded forcefully. Absolutely, she chimed in. Godfrey went on. Now, I want everyone watching to retain absolute clarity that the messengers have always wanted to cooperate with us. The problem has long been a lack of political will on Earth, and particularly a lack of international political will. That's why the ICA's breakaway from the UN was so important, because it unbound us from many restrictions that prevented cooperation. Now, the ICA is our point of global cooperation, no longer requiring a vote any time we want to do anything, as was the case when Dan and I, along with Terra, were trying to make silk purses out of sow's ears during our Unica days. Wrong, Cole said. Enlighten me, Godfrey challenged, looking as serene as he could despite the provocation that came with simply looking at John Cole and his endlessly punchable face. Cole shrugged, like his line of argument should have been the most obvious thing in the world. Ding, China. They don't want us to mine on New Kerguelen, and since you're in his pocket, that means we're not mining on New Kerguelen. Godfrey could hardly hide his disdain for such a poorly presented and logically inconsistent point. John, first things first, I hadn't even been formally inaugurated when the messengers needed my help on New Kerguelen. You're talking as though I've been ruling out mining proposals for months on end, when really none have come and I have spent quite literally minutes at the new ICA since the doors formally opened. But underlying all of this are the two core points that I am not at the behest of any nation and that China has expressed no opposition to mining on New Kerguelen. Because you haven't asked them about it, Jan Geller butted in. Beside her, Slater stayed quiet. Tell me, do you ever ask the Chinese about anything contentious? As soon as the idea is seriously raised in Buenos Aires, Ding will kick up a fuss and maybe even pick up his ball and go home. You know that as well as I do, and you know why as well as I do. China has a near monopoly on many rare earth metals, as we all know, and that was one of very few things Richard Walker was ever publicly right about. The timing of this allusion to Walker and his Sinophobic worldview, coming as it did so soon after a video he recorded with sections on that very topic had resurfaced, struck Dan as some kind of coincidence. Valerie Slater joined the fray at this point. It is worth remembering that China has been buying up African mines and striking all kinds of quid pro quo arrangements to ensure their exclusive access to mines they can't buy outright. There are some rare metals of which China holds almost the entire global stores. If China owns 90% of some metal and we discover a mine on New Kerguelen, which doubles the amount at our disposal, China now owns 45%. You see, they don't want to dilute their holding percentages, some of which get very consequential at certain threshold points, and they do this for the more obvious and absolute reason of trying to hold, or perhaps even fix, the trading price of certain metals. They don't want any new discoveries which could dilute their relative holdings of certain metals or deflate the absolute price of those selfsame metals. It's as simple and as selfish as that, really. Even after this apparent punchline, and in fact, especially after it, neither Emma nor Godfrey could fully understand why Slater and Cole had made this their first substantive point of the night. If they had shown more strategic intelligence over the years than they actually had, Emma might have been thinking they were attempting to lull her and Godfrey into a false sense of security with the intention of both suddenly and aggressively raising the stakes at some future point. He's not a reliable ally of the West, John Cole then blurted out, pointing a chubby finger at Godfrey.
He isn't a true ally at all.
The ICA chairman instinctively chuckled. I'm sorry, aren't you the man who worked for Ding in his China-led Earth Liaison Forum in direct opposition to the unabashedly pro-Western Global Contact Commission I led with fairly capable assistance of the forgetful president at your side?
As I was saying, Cole grunted, a theatrical eye roll thrown in for good measure, Godfrey lives with a foot in both camps. He has been closer to Ding than he has to Western leaders in the past few months, and let's not forget that he sold out his country twice to take on roles that offered him greater personal prestige. I am a two-time prime minister too, but my initial reign ended due to a regrettable error of judgment for which I take full responsibility. Each of his ended because he saw a shinier seat in Argentina. The people of Britain know what he is, and I dearly hope enough leaders within the ICA can see it before they let him entrench his power, get in bed with Ding, and prevent the commencement of a massive and globally beneficial mining program on New Kerguelen. But Godfrey has spent his career working shoulder to shoulder, or maybe I should say snout to snout, with all manner of questionable governments.
Godfrey couldn't even chuckle this time, so surprised was he with the barefaced cheek of John Cole, of all men making this last comment, given how recently he had worked as a business consultant for borderline pariahs during his time out of frontline politics, cashing in on his old titles, which could bring credibility to others who desperately needed it. For the first time since the show began, the value of Leisha's presence became clear.
They want you to call him out for the consultancy work, the alien reported, having heard this thought at the forefront of both Cole and Slater's conscious minds. They're trying to push a narrative of equivalency, and they want to paint you as petty. Avoid it.
Well, Godfrey shrugged, turning to Marion de Klerk. What I'd really like to talk about first, and what I'm sure your viewers are far more interested in than this game of petty false equivalencies, is Dortlu Tepe, the Turkish site where some very exciting carvings have recently been found. My friends across the desk have taken some very odd and irresponsible actions relating to this site, and I would also like to discuss yesterday's brutal murder of the site's discoverer within the grounds of the same hotel where my friends here were staying and from which Mesut's images were stolen. Their views on... We'll move right along to Dortlu Tepe after the first of our short commercial breaks. Marion de Klerk cut in. Because the show was airing on Blitz News, there were to be considerably more such breaks than normal, breaking the standard format which allowed 20 solid minutes for each of two topics. That model had always held great appeal to viewers, and increasingly so in an age when TV shows could rarely run for even 10 consecutive minutes without a break. Godfrey was frustrated by the interruption, but far less so than he would have been if Leisha hadn't silently delivered another piece of important data to all of his allies at once.
They're guilty. Cole was behind Masoud's death, and Slater knew he was doing it. Slater is in less deep. He brought the images to her and asked if she wanted in. With Godfrey gone, she had to hitch her wagon to the anti-Godfrey horse rather than linger and get lost in the shuffle whether he came back or didn't.
That's all at the forefront of their minds? Emma asked, somewhat surprised. Leisha, invisible and silent, replied in the affirmative.
Godfrey pushed enough of the right buttons to bring the thoughts up. Thoughts of guilt do tend to be the clear...
The telepathically delivered words suddenly ceased at the very moment that a commotion suddenly began as the uncharacteristically quiet and perhaps slightly out of his conversational and political depth, Clark McCarthy seemed to lose his balance while leaning back in his chair and scratching his neck. He barely managed to grab hold of the desk before he fell all the way backwards, but did so just in time.
Smooth,
Emma chided with a grin, stepping in to make light of the situation. Clark, however, didn't look amused. He wasn't at all annoyed by Emma's reaction, but rather the remotely applied force that had almost caused him to fall over in the first place. Dan and Godfrey shared a confused look until a telepathic thought from Clark entered each of their minds at once.
For fuck's sake, Leisha, what the hell are you doing?